The difference between democracy and republic could be demonstrated once again in the coming days should both houses of Congress pass a tax cut bill that is very unpopular in poll after poll. We do have a say in our government, but it's largely through who we elect. Can it be more? Our guests this hour say yes, emphatically. Francis Moore LePay and Adam Eichen insist that the remedy for what troubles America is more democracy, not less. They are the co-authors of Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. Francis Moore LePay co-founded the Small Planet Institute and has written 18 previous books, including Diet for a Small Planet. Thank you for joining us, Francis.
Thank you, Jeff.
Adam Eichen is a Democracy Fellow at the Small Planet Institute, is a board member of Democracy Matters, and was Deputy Communications Director for Democracy Spring. So bona fides on both sides there. Adam, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you both clearly have come to the conclusion that we do not have enough democracy. Can each of you break it down on specific things that are missing, starting with you, Francis?
Well, let me say first what we think democracy is. It's a governance, a form of governance that is where power is distributed. We all have some, where public affairs are transparent, and where we are all responsible, not just a blamers, you know, not just blamers. So those conditions are what defines democracy, and today the rules are moving us away from that, and yet there is a movement arising to move us toward creating those conditions that really bring out the best in our humanity.
All right. And Adam, for you, what does democracy mean, and what are the things that are missing right now?
I echo what Frankie said right there, and I think that the key thing for us is that democracy is, when you boil it down, is really the essence of human dignity. It's about giving people a voice in their own future, and clearly we don't have that today. Our democratic institutions, our government itself, is dictated by those who can spend the most money on campaigns or lobbying. And not everyone can even vote in our elections, whether it's because of long lines or voter ID laws or many other different things that we chronicle in the book. But clearly what we have today is an unrepresentative system, really embodied, as you started off with, you know, the tax bill, which is profoundly unpopular. And yet, many politicians have come on record saying, if we don't pass this, our donors say never call us again. If that's not an indictment of our current system, I don't really know what is.
So it's not a case, Adam, of barnacles growing on the system. It's just sort of gathered dust and gotten a little calcified over the years. This is a more direct kind of a taking away rather than just a sloughing off.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the key arguments we make in our book. Now, our book is different from many others that are out there, insofar as, you know, we spend most of the book talking about the solutions, about the positive movement for reform. But we do devote two short chapters to chronicling what we call the anti-democracy movement, a movement that started in 1971 when a soon-to-be Supreme Court Justice, Lewis Powell, wrote a memo for the Chamber of Commerce, in which he outlined how to get the business point of view back into politics. I know that seems very difficult for many of your listeners to kind of come to grips with. It certainly was for us to believe that there was a time when business was, quote-unquote, not heard. But, you know, they really did feel that way. And so they outlined this plan, which really took shape in the 70s and then 80s and onward, to undermine our institutions and undermine democracy so as to really put forward this kind of real free market, anti-government approach to everything, and that included things from shaping our the way we think, you know, through think tanks and funding for educational scholarships, et cetera, to, you know, shaping the media, consolidation, et cetera, and then also rigging the rules of our democracy, so voter suppression laws and unleashing money in politics. It really was a deliberate effort. That is one of our key arguments here.
That Lewis Powell note, in fact, comes with a date, August 23rd, 1971. Francis, can you give us some context? I mean, this is still after, not long after, a lot of protests in the streets during the 60s, and apparently also a period of great concern about communism, too, wasn't it, still?
Well, yes. It's more than just protests in the streets. I mean, I was part of the war on poverty, and we cut the poverty rate in half in a little more than a decade. And so there was a lot of progress that a lot of us felt. And even Republicans were behind environmental protections that were enacted in that time. And so there was a lot happening that was solutions-oriented. I want to underscore that. It wasn't just protesting the war, for example, although that was important. But the way that Lewis Powell interpreted that was a direct threat. It is striking to read his words, and he talks about the attempt to destroy the free enterprise system. And he singles out Ralph Nader as a particular bad guy. And all he wanted to do, of course, then was save us from exploding cars. And so it's really interesting how deeply concerned Lewis Powell was. And that then developed a sort of playbook for how do we defend this, what they called free enterprise system. Adam used the term free market. That's the term used. But actually, as we argue in our book, what we have in America is really a market that is driven by one rule. I mean, there's no such thing as an unruled market. They all have rules. And ours is this. It is do what brings highest return to existing wealth. So this worldview that has been so successfully put through, this playbook that Lewis Powell laid out, ends up in creating such extreme inequality that we have a deeper inequality than virtually all of the Western world, and including the country of India, for example. I mean, it's so extreme. And that just doesn't work for a society with extreme inequality. There's tremendous evidence that inequality itself is related to worse health outcomes, worse educational outcomes, and on and on.
So you're saying it's existing wealth, though. We're not talking about then, as is often touted, like we're going to make new millionaires. This is not about that, you're saying.
Well, it's about accumulation. And that goes to the top. So who has benefited? It is those at the top one half of 1% have, you know, over a period of time have, you know, quadrupled, I believe it is, their wealth in a very short period of time. Whereas if you look at the income of the average worker's household, that has basically barely budged since Lewis Powell wrote that memo. So there's this increasing gap between those struggling to get by and those soaring to the top.
We're talking to Francis Moore LePay and Adam Eichen about their book, Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. We kind of shot right to the middle of the book. We'll come back and pick up some of the details from the beginning when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to the activists Francis Moore LePay and Adam Eichen from the Small Planet Institute about their latest work together called Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. They've already made the case that it is a concerted effort from people of means to make sure that the power is consolidated in the hands of a few. The people with money and power should keep money and power in this country. You can join the conversation on the Exchange with your thoughts, your questions, your comments. Explore the issues with Francis and Adam. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. It will startle a few people to read, as I did early in the book, that you're saying we are not a fundamentally divided people. Can you explain that, Adam?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, if you look at poll after poll, you know, Americans are united on many different issues, even though we're led to believe that we really are fundamentally divided. And, on, you know, really what inspires us the most, or at least what gives me the most encouragement, is that especially on this fundamental issue of democracy, about representation, or as we like to call it, human dignity, Americans are not only not divided, but they are all but they're essentially completely united on this issue of representation. I mean, you look at poll after poll, you know, whether it's about money in politics, 85% of Americans want fundamental changes in the way we fund our elections. 75% of Americans feel that they have too little influence in Washington, D.C., basically saying that they feel completely powerless. And you see this in poll after poll. And Americans also agree on solutions. Just one example, 72% of Americans support the idea of implementing a public financing system for our elections, basically kind of using some public money to defer the cost of elections, basically reducing the time that candidates have to spend fundraising and allowing them to spend more time listening to, well, what are the issues that my constituents care about? So you see this in poll after poll, especially when it comes to these issues of representation and democracy, you know, and so that really is counter to the narrative that we're fed on a daily basis, that the problem, the divide is intractable. The divide just cannot be breached. And so we really, from the get-go, say, no, that's not the case at all, that we have tremendous grounds to start making progress right now.
And it's at this point in the book, Daring Democracy, that you give what you call three powerful ideas. Number one, that democracy is essential. Number two, that democracy is possible. Number three, that there's a role for each person in making democracy real. So, Francis, what practices does this lead to? Are we talking about, for example, voting on everything? Is it that democratic? I mean, one of our counties nearby used to vote on fees for everything.
Well, I think we start with fair voting in terms of who represents us. Certainly that is the place that we're focusing here, and that's why I was so delighted to hear about your small donor elections approach that is being pursued in Oregon. But this is an example of a way that reduces the power of private wealth in the system and increases the opportunity for regular people to run. It's worked in Maine, where I've met a waitress who was able to run because of clean elections, a similar sort of approach. I mean, it looks like what you're proposing there in Oregon is a 6-to-1 match. If somebody wants to run for office, if they can get a certain number of small donors and agree not to accept money from anybody who contributes over $250 a year, that then the public picks it up and you can get a 6-to-1 match. And it works. It works to expand the number of people, and you can tap this talent of undiscovered. For example, my friend Deb Simpson, who was a waitress who used the Maine system called Clean Elections, somewhat similar, and she was reelected 5 times and pushed forward with incredibly important environmental legislation and other social protections that are really have improved the lives of people in Maine. So I think this kind of system that enables money to be set aside, and the heart of the question is who's capable, who is competent, who is committed to run.
So it's about lowering bars for entry. I mean, not for people who want to run, in addition for people who want to just get in there and vote.
Exactly, exactly. And therefore, we have real choices. And certainly, automatic voter registration, another reason I'm proud to say that I was born in Oregon, is that, you know, you led the country in that. And then others, you know, one of our refrains in the book is that courage is contagious. So when one state steps up and shows what impact automatic voter registration can have, and how I believe it's something close to 100,000 new voters voted as a result of this process that you introduced, and others now, there are 10 states and District of Columbia that have implemented a similar approach. So it just lowers the barrier, I think, is a nice way of putting it. In fact, this is another unity point that was building on what Adam was saying about how much unity there is, that close to 70% of us say that we want to do everything possible to make it easy for people to vote, because, you know, especially poor people who have less time, they work longer hours and less transportation, that they are disadvantaged in a system that, with restrictions such as voter IDs and limited voting hours and limited polling places and that sort of thing.
We are talking to Francis Moore LePay and Adam Eichen, the co-authors of the book Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. Adam, do you think democracy is a natural thing for humans? It does involve a lot of sharing, which, particularly in the American example, is not necessarily the place we go first.
I mean, I think humans are capable of both good and evil, and I think that's kind of one of the fundamental things that we have to realize about humanity. But I think that what democracy depends on is the rules that we set for ourselves. So while humans can commit unspeakable evil, if we set good rules through, you know, governments and through the institutions that we create, then yes, democracy is not only possible, but I think, or at least what we argue, is it's the only system of governance that actually brings forth the best in who we are. It creates a sense of mutual accountability with one another, a sense that we all have a power. There's a dispersion of, you know, of power as well. And so I really do think, and I think we believe, that no, it's not inevitable, but if we set the correct rules, it's possible and it brings forth the best in who we are. And again, that's why when our book, what we're talking about in terms of what we're advocating for, it's system reforms. We're not saying, you know, oh, we need to vote on everything, although, you know, that's an interesting discussion, but that's not really what we're getting at here. It's that what we have right now is not a representative system, because the rules that we've set have been, you know, cut down over the past 40 years. So anything protecting, you know, or creating a system which really should be representative and have people act on the public interest, those rules have been taken away, which is why, again, that, you know, we're so excited, you know, for things like public finance of elections. I mean, the fact that Oregon is now considering implementing a small donor election system, you know, the group there, A Voice for All of Oregon. So if anybody's interested in really joining that fight, which I'm sure we'll talk about how the fight for democracy reforms, these system reforms, is proliferating across the country, becoming what we really identify as a democracy movement. You know, I encourage people to check out A Voice for All Oregon and really fight for this public financing bill in Oregon, because I really do think this is a fundamental step to setting the rules to allow for a representative system, a system of democracy that really does listen to all voices, all constituents, not just those who can give, you know, large campaign contributions or spend a lot of money on lobbying.
So thus far, we've talked about problems with democracy as we practice it, and problems with the market system and need for reform there, and what you call the one rule market, where the money collects to the people already at the top. Do we correct the democracy and then that system fixes the markets, or do they get fixed simultaneously? Francis?
Well, we've created what we call brutal capitalism that is just driven by this one rule. And the vision that is growing around the world is the democratization of an economy, so that the economy is re-embedded in the values and norms of a society. And that means that, yes, you know, there are still private firms, of course, but that they are accountable to norms of encouraging, for example, the voices of workers through unions, instead of, as it has happened over the last several decades, making it harder for unions to form. And it also encourages worker ownership, some form of that is cooperatives. And, in fact, I'm reading this delightful book now about Italy, that the most prosperous region, 40% of the firms are cooperatives, and it has the highest income of all of Italy. So there are many ways that we can create vibrant markets where power is widely dispersed and we all have a voice. So this gets us away from this brutal capitalism where you either make it or you don't, the idea that the market just sorts out winners and losers fairly when it is just driven by this, how do you make the most immediate return to those who already have wealth? So that's the vision. And I want to add on to what Adam was saying about human nature and underscore that we have a chapter called The Thrill of Democracy, where we talk about this is not some wonky thing for, you know, people who love government. This is really about our desire for meaning in our lives and connection with others and, you know, a sense of common purpose. So this is a thrilling undertaking is what we're discovering and millions of Americans are.
Francis Moore LePay and Adam Eichen are our guests on the Jefferson Exchange. They are the co-authors of Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. You're more than welcome to join the discussion on the exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Bruce and Ashlyn. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the exchange. Go ahead, Bruce. Bruce, you there? All right, there is no Bruce. We will put him on hold and hope we can find him again. Let me go a little further into the issue that you face when you're trying to reform a system of self-governance and a system of markets and money at the same time, because so often the claim that comes from people who are in positions of financial responsibility and some power is that anything you do is going to kill jobs. You're just trying to either take from the rich and give to the poor, or you're going to kill jobs. How do you respond to those, Adam Eichen?
Well, it's difficult because that point of view has been so thoroughly put into our minds through mostly, you know, right-wing think tanks that have been funded by billionaire families and corporations like the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institute. So it's very difficult to kind of cut past that narrative that's so, you know, been so ingrained in our minds. But, I mean, we've also been shown that in the 40-year experiment in this kind of, you know, trickle-down economic system, it doesn't work. That really what actually hurts the economy the most is when you cut off any sort of growth from the bottom and, you know, you give it all to the top, like this Republican tax bill will do. So it's very hard. So on the one hand, we have to, you know, operate on facts when it comes to, you know, economic policy. But we also have to show is that, you know, fighting for democracy reform and making sure that all people have, you know, the ability to be viable in our economy, to sustain themselves, that actually creates a society that is more secure, that there's more freedom, right? We have to reconceptualize freedom. Freedom doesn't just mean freedom from things. It's not just, you know, the freedom not to be live under a tyrant. It also means the freedom to do. It's not, you know, it's the freedom to participate in government. It's the freedom to live a happy life. And I think that we have to do a better job, all of us have to do a better job of really articulating what our vision is. That we have to articulate, well, what is the society that we want to live under, and the ways in which government and public good and a economy that works for all feed into that. And I think that it's difficult, but we really have to watch our words and really do a better job of articulating the narrative that we want to see.
Well, government is often the enemy in this context, isn't it? Particularly when you start talking about economics. I mean, given a choice between, well, do I make things easier for business or make things easier for government? It seems to be that the tendency is to go for business.
Absolutely, that's been the government policy verbatim for the last 40 years. Absolutely.
Let us take another. Let's see. Bruce in Ashland, I believe, is on the line now. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Adam Eichen and Francis Moore LaPay.
Well, I hope you can hear me now.
Yes.
Okay, good. I wanted to point out that I think we lost our democracy when Kennedy was killed. The new papers released about that show conclusively that the CIA and the FBI were involved in the removal of our president. And then we kind of had this deep state, you know, go into running drugs to get their money to run their black ops. So I think and then I want to jump quickly to how we could change democracy to be more representative of the individual, because this republic was invented back in the horse and buggy days, so we needed to send people off to Washington. I think each one in the country should get a blockchain identification, not to hide it, not to be private, but we each have a definite identification, and we all vote for things every month, not once every 4 years or every 2 years. Anyway, I wanted to know what you think about that. And one last thing is, I think that the tax bill is good. It might give more to the rich, but I and my wife make less than $30,000 a year, and this tax bill will help us immensely, especially getting rid of the mandate. And I think the media is portraying it wrong. That's it.
All right. Thanks, Bruce. Appreciate that. All right. So thoughts, Francis?
Well, I hope that you do well, but nothing that the Trump administration has done has led me to believe that he really has the interest of people in your situation at heart. And I've heard that once we get rid of that mandate, then the cost of health care for all of us will be going up. And so I'm just very worried about it, because I haven't seen the values of what we're talking about, democratic values of dispersing power and benefiting those who have been most hurt by the economic system. So we'll see about that. But I just want to underscore that what we're talking about here is understanding that economic life is a piece of the overall democratic process, and that you look at where you were asking about jobs. Well, where have large corporations, those at the very top, created jobs? They are stashing a lot of their profits overseas, and they're putting their investments abroad to pay people even less than they would pay them here. Whereas another way of increasing the number of jobs and good jobs is to keep the money here and strengthen unions that I pointed out and encourage cooperatives. I want to make the point that after the big crash in 2008, cooperatives as a sector did not lose jobs the way that the private ownership did. This cooperative ownership was able to retain workers, and that was very important to the well-being of people all over the country. So I just want to underscore this question, fundamentally come back to power. Whose voices can be heard both in the economic sphere and in the political?
To go a little further into what Bruce was talking about with the idea of us voting on things monthly, that does raise the issue of technology and how it can help us. I mean, We have on one hand the possibility of talking to pretty much anybody in the world on the internet in almost a moment's notice, but it happens through social media like Facebook and so forth that we talk to people who feel the way we do. So is there a role for technology in increasing democracy, Adam?
Of course there is. There's always, as technology advances, there's always more opportunity to use that technology to make our systems more democratic. And you look at what's happening with the FCC right now on the vote on net neutrality. I mean, the number of public comments that have been submitted via the internet is, stunning. It's in it's in the 500,000 category a couple weeks ago. Absolutely. The internet and other things really do take democracy to a new level. However, what I'll say is before we can get all, wide-eyed about the role of technology, we have to do a much better job of using the technology that we kind of already have. And so what I mean by that is, we haven't done anything to make sure that our voting, our voting systems and the election machine, the polling machines are secure. We know that they're not. They're easily hackable. And I'm not, saying that they've been hacked. That's not the point at all.
But
we know election security as we run our systems now is in dire threat. We know that the systems aren't secure. We know that our voter registration databases have had breaches.
So there's a lot of stuff to fix here, too. We'll bring it back to this point with Adam Eichen and Francis Moore LePay, the authors of Daring Democracy, when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guests are Francis Moore LePay and Adam Eichen, both activists, both at the Small Planet Institute. They have joined forces for a book called Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. Their argument is more democracy, not less, makes our country a better place and wrests power away from the rich and powerful who make sure they continue to keep all the power to themselves. You can join us on the exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about the net, which leads us into the zone of net neutrality, which the FCC is supposed to take up actually today. But the FCC was also responsible for previous regulations that sort of kept things a bit more equal in society, like the Fairness Doctrine. Can you take us down that road, Francis?
Yes. Originally, not too many decades ago, before the Powell memo really got to have its full effect, it was understood that the public airways were public good, that we all benefited, that they were ours. And so FCC really saw that it was important, therefore, that the interest, in fact, there's a beautiful ruling stating in no uncertain terms that it's the interest of the listeners and the viewers that matter, not the owners or the operators. And so there was the Fairness Doctrine, which simply said that to have a public right to use a public airway, you had to show a variety of views and have balance in what you do. And that was wiped out during the Ronald Reagan era.
Which gave the rise to people like Rush Limbaugh and stations that are all right-wing, all talk all the time.
Right. And then the Telecommunications Act of 96 did this next step, which is reduce the rules against monopoly, so that today we have Sinclair Broadcasting, for example, which is a very far-right organization, that can now reach 71% of all households in America because we removed the rules that could limit monopoly power over our communication system.
That deal's not finalized yet, though, is it? Sinclair Tribune?
I thought it was.
I'm going to have to look that one up.
It's a regulatory loophole, and it seems like it'll go through.
All right. But basically, the lid
Thank you for that correction.
The lid was under 40% originally of the country that could be reached by one company of broadcasters, and now it's it potentially goes up to over 70%.
Yeah, it's very scary stuff.
So, I want to bring back the listeners who are just joining us, but the Powell memo is a memo by Lewis Powell, Supreme Court Justice, in 1971, talking about the attacks on free enterprise as he saw it, and how this spurred a lot of activity from folks to make sure that the power would stay in the hands of people who had it, and that it would stay in the hands of the money would stay in the hands of people with money. Now, you mentioned in the book you're not going to blame the ultra rich, but you do, and you really bring in the various names we've heard of. And I wonder, though, for every Robert Mercer on the right, is there a George Soros or similar boogeyman on the left?
Well, let me just say, jump in here, because there's really, I think, a false equivalency. Obviously, no, we're not saying all billionaires are anti-democracy. What we are saying is that a handful have had enormous influence over undermining our democracy. George Soros, he's also, and I know other people, part of the Democracy Alliance, for example, wealthy people who also get involved, but their agenda is really for democracy. It's working to support reforms to make democracy more real in our country. And I can also add that their wealth is big, but it's not anywhere near as big. The Koch brothers are many multiples of the wealth of those who are working toward democracy. So I think there's really, and also let me add another way they're different is that those who are working for democracy are more, you know, democratic in how they decide what they're going to do. They talked, you know, they let those who align with them decide how to use their money, whereas the Koch approach, the far right, is very coordinated. They meet biannually. The Koch brothers host this gathering where you have to fork over $100,000 to get in, and then you really agree on one agenda, and that's very top-down. So there are many ways that they are different. So we want to make sure that we're not talking about conspiracies or evil people. We are talking about a mindset that group of very wealthy billionaires, you know, hold that has been very damaging, that is very damaging.
Is it fair to sum up what you're talking about here then, Adam, as you think the money should come out of politics and the people should go in?
Yeah. I mean, there will always be money in politics. You need money to communicate and you need money to run a campaign. So it's not that you get all money out, right? I mean, I think that often stymies action. People say, oh, well, money is like water, right? It'll always find a leak. But that's not exactly the point. The point is that we can do a much better job, that we need to reduce money's influence, big money's influence, right? The idea that one person can single-handedly, you know, sway an election. I think that most of us, if not all of us, except for the wealthiest among us, would agree that's probably not exactly democratic. And ultimately, yeah, the goal is to figure out ways, what are the policies in which we can bring people back into politics? Because we know that most people, I mean, there are studies that show, there's one study that examined some of the roll call votes in Congress in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, and these political scientists concluded that the average American had, quote, near zero influence on public policy, while the elite, those who have the most money, the wealthy, had significant influence. I mean, no one believes that system is either ideal or tenable, for that matter. So I think ultimately, yeah, it's about finding the policies which, one, we know exist, and two, know work, that, you know, fighting for those policies. And that really is where our book, it differs from a lot of the books on the subject, because we don't claim to have discovered this anti-democracy movement. We gave it a name that we thought was fitting, the anti-democracy movement, because really, as Francis was saying, it is a movement to undermine American democracy. I mean, we don't mince words on that. But, you know, where our book is different, so we draw on a lot of books that have already been out there, like Jane Mayer's Dark Money or Zachary Roth's book, The Great Suppression, right? We draw on those books, but really what we think our book does different, and I think it's one that your listeners would really appreciate, especially in these kind of despairing times, is that we chronicle that there are solutions and that there are people who are out there creating a movement to pass these solutions. So we're not just out there, you know, railing against the system. We're showing that, okay, here's the deal. Everyone knows our system's broken. But look, we have solutions, and people are already out in the streets. They're already doing the hard work of organizing to get these solutions passed, and that once they get it passed, they're working. And automatic voter registration, as Oregon's shown, is one of these key reforms that was implemented or passed in 2015, implemented in 2016, and in the first 3 months, you see triple number of people, new voters being registered. And then the numbers, you know, after a full year are just staggering. Almost, 300,000 new registered voters and about 100,000 of them voted in the 2016 election cycle. I mean, that's the perfect example of how you can have a simple change in public policy and you bring more people into the system. So Oregon, for us, is one of the best examples of really kind of this democracy movement that we're talking about.
So do your changes happen down the road, too, to things like amending the Constitution so that money is no longer considered speech, or is it all about just making sure people get into the process at the beginning and so they can take part in it?
Yes, that's not possible it's only possible as we do the work that Adam just so beautifully articulated, and that is happening. And what's so sad to us and what motivates us is to make that visible so that people know they can be part of something that is national and yet local too, as you're showing in cities and in Oregon as a whole. So I think that's the key here, is to really help people dissolve the sense of despair over the concentration of power and the moving backward, and realize that actually there is a movement that is succeeding and proven to work.
Let's take a call here. We have Kent in Rogue River on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Francis Moore LePay and Adam Eichen, the co-authors of Daring Democracy.
Thank you. Good morning. I have a simple-minded, naive idea, maybe. I think that it would be good to establish another bureaucracy where, if you wanted to contribute any money to any politicians, PACs, or whatever, that money be required to go through a clerk. And that clerk would just simply write down and make public the amount of money, where it came from, and where it came from would have to be a person, not another PAC, not any way to hide the source of the money. And that way, you'd know at least where the money is coming from.
All right, so they don't give the money to the PACs, and the PACs give the money to the people, and you don't know who the people giving to the people are.
Right. So you know exactly who's funding
All right,
bribes.
All right. Thanks for that, Kent. Appreciate it. Francis and Adam, any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, you can go, Frankie.
Disclosure is one of the key words here on democracy, this transparency. And California just passed an important piece of legislation that, for example, would require in any ad in a political campaign that right off the bat in the beginning you see who are the three largest sources of funds that made that ad possible. That's not where your caller, it's not there yet, but that is the direction where transparency is key, and that people are required to identify who they're giving money to.
We also have an email here from Larry in Ashland who says, how do we get younger candidates who have the vision and enthusiasm to engage in conventional electoral politics? When I talk to people in their late 20s through mid-40s, they're concerned about the issues of democracy and economy, but it's very difficult in today's society to afford basic rent, food, loan payments. That leaves only wealthy or much older individuals able to afford to engage in running for office. That, again, from Larry in Ashland. Adam, you want to take that one?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that really kind of gets to the core of my person right here, because, I mean, I'm a young person as well, and, I think that if we're going to really advance our country, we need to make sure we get the voices of young people involved, because, they're a core constituency. And I think that that's one of the reasons why public financing of elections is so important, that in states that have passed public financing, you do see young people able to run, because, honestly, one of the hardest things to run for office is to have a network of people who will fund your campaign. So this is why, most politicians are white, male, and older, and generally have a law degree or some sort of professional degree that allow them to make networks of people who have a lot of money. So when you break down that barrier, you see an increase in young people running, in people of color running, in women running, in people who don't have a lot of money, so in lower socioeconomic levels. It really breaks down all the barriers to running for office. So for me, if you're interested in getting young people to run for office, one, we have to really develop a culture of encouraging young people to get involved with politics. I really think that right now, and it's been very deliberate to really delegitimize government and to make it something that is nasty and you don't want to be a part of, and it's almost a shame to say that you're interested in politics, right? So we really have to kind of work on that cultural aspect. But the structural, the policy aspect is public financing of elections. I think that makes the biggest difference. So if any of your listeners really want to bring young people or women or people of color or people of all, wealth backgrounds into the political process, my advice to you is join that campaign right now for public financing of elections in Oregon. For me, that is the single most important piece of reform that can happen to bring young people into politics.
Francis, you had mentioned working on the war on poverty, so you clearly have a memory back to days when people thought government could be cool, and it's not now in a lot of people's eyes. I mean, how do you restore that level of the sense of this is what we do together, government is what we do together?
Exactly, exactly. Well, I see it happening, and I see it in Adam, you know, and the group that he came up with, so to speak, at Vassar. It's called Democracy Matters, and it's got chapters in over 40 campuses, and the young people get to decide what democracy issue they work on. Getting their fellow students out to vote certainly is one key one. And so it begins to develop this deep sense that you are going to the heart of the problem. Yes, you care about the environment and other things, as young people, many, many do, but they're getting it. And so many other organizations are getting it that we can't solve any of those questions without democracy itself. So that excitement about actually going to the heart of the problem, I think, really appeals to young people. And our march from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C. for democracy reforms in 2016, a lot of young people participated. And Adam usually tells the story, but I'll just grab the mic, so to speak. But Democracy Matters, they always ask their members, you know, how many of you want to run for office, and usually it's only a handful at their annual meeting. But the last annual meeting, half these young people, these students, when asked that question, half of them raised their hands. Yes, I want to run for office, and some even had filed to run for office already.
Okay, so change is definitely on the way. We're talking about Daring Democracy is the name of the book, subtitled Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. Francis Moore LePay, Adam Eichen, the co-authors of the book, both at the Small Planet Institute. Adam and Frankie, thank you so much for joining us today.